Everyone knows that Santa Claus is getting ready for his annual Christmas delivery of presents to good little boys and girls around the world. But how does he get it all done? In the next few minutes, spoiler alert, we'll reveal some of the high-tech tools Santa uses to tackle this monumental challenge. Here to explain is Gregory Moe. He's an editor at Popular Science magazine and is now out with a book of Santa science: The Truth About Santa, Wormholes, Robots, and What Really Happens on Christmas Eve. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
One of the ways you begin this book is talking about an interesting idea from the science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke. And I'll quote here, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." And that certainly applies to Santa Claus in a way.
Exactly. I think part of the reason people look at Santa and say it's all magic is that his job does seem impossible, this notion of getting around the world and visiting all these homes in a single night. But the reason he can do it is that he has incredibly advanced technology. Santa's tools and his toys are effectively a few hundred years beyond anything that we have here at our disposal. And as a result, it does seem like magic. But it's really all science and technology.
Well, we can't get to everything that you have in the book, but let's begin with something that we all know about, the red suit. Now, looks cozy, but I gather it's more than a fashion statement in those sub-zero North Pole temperatures that Santa spends most of his time in.
Absolutely. Santa's suit, it looks like just sort of almost a snuggie, a wearable blanket, but in fact, it's tuned for extreme conditions and also extreme instances where he might need to become, say, invisible. Santa's suit is laden with what are called metamaterials, which have this effect of bending light around a person so that they turn invisible. It's something like Harry Potter's invisibility cloak, for example.
Now, Santa always seems to have reading glasses perched on his nose. Whenever you see him portrayed in it, you know, up there in the North Pole, indoors, you know, as if maybe he's reading children's letters. They are special, though, those glasses.
Absolutely. They're very special. And it is kind of a quaint, cute image. But in fact, these glasses have what's called a heads-up display, where when Santa looks through those lenses, he sees a whole range of information, both about the house he's visiting, the presents he's supposed to leave, the residents, including, you know, the children and whether they've been naughty or nice. And it also allows him to figure out where he's going next and how to get there. It's almost like a GPS map that we have in our car.
Right, but so much more than that.
So much more. And scientists are developing some technology like this today, but they're not quite at Santa's level.
Now, there's something that surprised me, but it actually makes perfect sense, and that's that he has a special device to make sure that he doesn't deliver gifts that are already under the tree. I mean, maybe something Mom and Dad bought. Last thing you'd want is to double up on, you know, G.I. Joe or something like that.
Exactly. Now, Santa knows what we want, but he doesn't really know what presents to leave for a given kid until he gets to that house and looks under the tree. The issue here is that a lot of these presents are wrapped, and Santa doesn't have the time to unwrap every present and rewrap it to see what's inside. So he has a very advanced scanner that uses terahertz wave radiation to see through the wrapping and the cardboard and make out the shape inside. This vital information is then sent back to the North Pole, it's processed, and Santa receives a message saying, okay, this child has received this transformer or that doll, and he knows that he's supposed to leave something else.
And this is technology that exists.
Right. Well, I spoke with a researcher in terahertz radiation myself. These are scanners that scientists are working on. Jason Dickinson at the University of Massachusetts helped to imagine how Santa's scanner itself might work, because the truth is I don't have all the information about how Santa's operation works.
Hopefully we won't ruin anything by going through a few more of these. There's the sleigh. This is most interesting. He seems to be taking advantage of some technology that didn't really exist back when Santa began and doesn't depend as he has traditionally on reindeer.
Right. Well, Santa's sleigh has what's called warp drive, which instead of allowing him to get from point A to point B faster, it actually brings point B closer to point A. So it shrinks the space between the house he's leaving and the destination home. The reindeer are still helpful here, but he doesn't really require them for flying anymore.
So they're just cruising along.
Right, exactly. Well, I spoke to an astrophysicist at the University of Berkeley, Richard Mueller, and he suggested that, in fact, reindeer may not be able to fly. They might just be really good leapers. And what we're seeing when we think we see a reindeer flying off a rooftop is the reindeer jumping off, bringing the sleigh with them into the air, and then the whole set, the reindeer, Santa, his sleigh, all of it, disappearing into a warp bubble created by one of these warp drive engines.
A warp bubble. Is there a quick explanation of that?
Well, Santa's warp drive engine, it bends space and twists space-time in such a way that it can shorten the distance between two points. It's sort of like leaving the known visible universe and slipping back in again at a different point.
It is not just technology that you're talking about here. You're also talking about a different sort of science, a sort of social science. Child psychology, apparently, thanks to Mrs. Claus, has entered into Santa's thinking.
Right. Well, this notion of kids being either naughty or nice and Santa leaving coal and if they've been bad and sort of ruining their Christmas doesn't entirely work. You know, Mrs. Claus has been reading this kind of research in child psychology for years, and she's eventually, she made the point with Santa that positive reinforcement does work really well. So what Santa tries to do these days is, instead of highlighting negative behavior, he sees if a kid who's been behaving badly does something very nice, and he captures these sort of things through all of his surveillance devices, which are all around the world. Santa tries to highlight that and give this kid a present and encourage them and say, you know, hey, thanks for picking up little Billy off the playground the other day instead of pushing him and things like that. And because, you know, Santa knows he wants to have a positive effect on these children. And so when Mrs. Claus came to him with all this research and said, look, Santa, we need to change our ways, he was absolutely open to it.
Science writer Gregory Mohn is author of the new book, The Truth About Santa, Wormholes, Robots, and What Really Happens on Christmas Eve. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Today, three influential senators outlined the basics they'd like to see in legislation to control global warming and improve energy security. This outline could ultimately suggest a way towards a compromise in this highly polarized issue. That's because the three senators are a Democrat, a Republican, and an Independent. That's John Kerry of Massachusetts, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and Joe Lieberman of Connecticut. And joining us to talk about this plan and these three senators is NPR's Richard Harris. Richard, first, what is it that these senators are proposing?
Well, Michelle, they're talking about this in terms of a jobs and energy bill, but at its heart, it is really a global warming bill. The central idea is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 17% by the year 2020, and at least by 80% by the middle of the century, which are very ambitious targets. And they talk about getting there by boosting renewable energy supplies, which, of course, is a very popular idea, and to do research to see if it's possible to capture carbon dioxide from coal. That's obviously one of the major sources of carbon dioxide in our country right now. They also do say that additional nuclear power is an essential component of this framework, and they also talk about increasing oil and gas production domestically, both on land and offshore. And, of course, that helps with the energy independence part, but not so much on the global warming front.
Now, any energy and climate bill in the Senate needs to have bipartisan support. How are these senators trying to sell this idea, as enthusiastic as they are about it, to their colleagues?
Well, they talk about it first and foremost as energy security. They note that we currently spend about $1 billion a day buying oil from overseas, often from people who don't like us particularly much. And they also talk about increasing jobs that will stay in the United States, things like building wind farms and building nuclear power plants. These are all sort of tied in with economic stimulus. They also talk about environmental benefits like cleaner air, and those issues have been historically less partisan than greenhouse gas control.
What's the early reaction to this proposal?
Well, it was submitted in a letter to the White House today, and the White House said thumbs up. They liked what they saw. Environmental groups have actually been mulling these ideas since Senators Kerry and Graham published an op-ed a few weeks ago in the New York Times. that outlines sort of the broad issues here. And the environmental groups are obviously not thrilled about nuclear power or even less thrilled about offshore oil drilling, but they do desperately want a climate deal. And it seems to be a sense among some of the mainstream groups that they're going to have to accept something they really don't like in order to get the things that they really do, the climate deal. Businesses are also split, I should mention. Some businesses who see a green economy as sort of inevitable say, let's get going, let's create a legal framework that will help us sort of do that. And of course, not unexpectedly, fossil fuel companies have been really fighting against climate and energy legislation.
When could the Senate actually take up this issue?
Well, the Senate could take this up in the spring, Senator Kerry said today. He has been sort of on the forefront of climate legislation, and he's been trying to figure out how to make it bipartisan. And his partnership with Senator Graham in particular, I think, really helped seal this issue. It's also important that this is happening right on the eve of President Obama's trip to Copenhagen. The timing is not coincidental here. President goes to Copenhagen next week to go to the climate talks. And although he's not ready to sign a climate deal, what he really does need to show is that the U.S. is serious about this issue. And this is one way to do that.
Richard, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That's NPR science correspondent Richard Harris.
As the Senate tries to work out a health care overhaul, it faces a constant balancing act between competing interests. Yesterday, union members were trying to get the attention of lawmakers. Their issue, opposition to a proposed tax on expensive health plans. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
The union members held their event in the cold December wind outside the Capitol, raising their voices as if to underscore the fact that they've struggled so far to be heard in the clamor over the health overhaul bill. Larry Cohen, president of the Communications Workers of America, urged senators to get rid of the bill's tax on so-called Cadillac health plans.
There's five other ways in the Senate and House bills to pay for health care in a fair way. There's only one way that's unfair. And that's this excise tax that will break the backs of the health care for 30 million Americans over the next 5 years.
The unions brought along some of their members they say could be affected by the proposed 40% tax on plans that cost more than $23,000 for a family and $8,500 for an individual. People like Gary Willett, who works at a grocery store warehouse in the Washington, D.C. area.
We gave up part of our wage increases to maintain our health and welfare benefits. I wouldn't call it a Cadillac health plan. I pay 20% of my major medical charges, and I have an annual deductible of $200.
Valerie Castle Stanley, who works for an AT&T call center in Southwest Virginia, says her family can't afford to pay any more.
We're not rich. We're average middle-class Americans. We need quality health care. When I heard some of our senators want to tax our health care, I just couldn't believe it.
All the workers, including Utah elementary school teacher Lily Eskelson, urged the Senate to follow the House's lead when it comes to paying for the health bill. Rather than taxing health benefits, the House bill imposes an income surtax on high-income earners.
Why would you not look first to millionaires to carry their fair share before you ask a third-grade teacher to carry the load?
But economists say there's a reason to include the tax on generous health plans. It's a first step towards slowing the rate of health care spending. Right now, health insurance is tax-free to both employers and workers, which economists say encourages overconsumption of health care. Paul Vandewater of the liberal think tank, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, says economists are big believers in incentives, in particular, that people respond to economic incentives they're given.
And if the price of health insurance goes up a bit because there's a tax placed on very expensive plans, it will encourage people to be more frugal in buying health insurance and provide one more incentive to find more efficient health insurance coverage.
Of course, what worries the unions most is that companies will simply avoid the tax by cutting benefits and not raising workers' wages. That's an argument that puzzles Vandewater.
In fact, the unions, who are amongst the most vocal critics of the proposal, have been amongst the first to say, well, we gave up cash wages to get better health insurance. And that's doubtless correct. But there's no reason that that machine doesn't work in reverse, just like it works in forward.
In other words, the unions can simply bargain the other way for cheaper benefits and bigger raises, and they'll have some time to do it. Under the bill, the excise tax doesn't take effect until the year 2013, but that's not dampened their opposition to the proposed tax. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. With just 15 days till Christmas, many of you may be in retail agony. You just can't think of what to get that special someone. Well, if that someone likes to cook, Dory Greenspan can help.
This is my favorite rolling pin. It's perfectly smooth and made of nylon.
Actually, it looks like a lightsaber, something from Star Wars. And it's a wonder she got it through airport security. But Dory is persuasive. She's the author of Baking, From My Home to Yours. And every year she comes to my house for our holiday baking segment. This year, she brought tools. And before we knew it, we were doing a tit-for-tat show-and-tell, starting with Dory's favorite cookie scoops.
You can use this for just about any cookie dough. Great for chocolate chip cookies. And it means that you just scoop and drop and all your cookies are the same size. And it's not a question of being perfect. It's a question of having them bake perfectly because they'll all be the same size. These are great. So cookie scoops.
One of the things that I love, it's a little...
It
looks like a little spoon that you might find in a Chinese restaurant or something. But
that's right.
Instead,
it's got that arch.
It has that sort of long ladle-like look to it. But instead of a solid base, it has a fine mesh base. And you can use that to sprinkle powdered sugar on top of cupcakes, or if you do like individual squares of gingerbread.
Right, or even cookies. It's just the right size. Fill it.
Perfect.
I love
for
this.
That.
Fill it with sugar and just give it a tap, tap. That's cool. Okay, well, this is, have you seen this yet?
It looks like a paddle that you would put in a mixer. Yes?
Exactly. It's called Beater Blade Plus. The company makes these for all kinds of mixers. I have a KitchenAid, so this fits my KitchenAid mixer. But see, it has these little silicone wings on the edge of the paddle. And so it wipes the edge of the bowl as you're beating. So it just, the silicone just extends the paddle just enough so that it sweeps the side of the bowl and cleans as it goes.
So it gets every last bit
right.
of
so
the
batter. Right, so that you end up, that's right, you end up not stopping the mixing as often to scrape down because the beater blade does it. I think it's very cool.
Well, speaking of stopping down, this is my next item. It is a spoon clip, and because it has the silicone in both the edging and the handle, you can clip it to a bowl if you're mixing up batter. But what I love about it is if you're making sauce or soup on the stove, you can just affix it right to the side of the pan.
Oh, that's cool.
One of my favorite things.
That's cool. Okay, well, this is one of my all-time favorite things, this cake plate. I love this plate. This one is a raised platter standing on a pair of shoes. It's so...
And just, not just any shoes. It's very kicky. They're
they're kind of high-buttoned and bowed shoes. It's such a whimsical thing. But a cake plate really... Do you know, even for plain chocolate chip cookies, nothing makes your sweet look better than to just lift it up off the counter and give it a nice little home.
Well, my last thing, Dory, is a jade green Fire King Pyrex bowl with a handle and a spout.
I grew up with that.
Well, I realized I grew up with it also. When I found this, it was a closeout item at a store. And I just have this unexplained attachment. And recently I was looking at home movies. It must have been my fourth or fifth birthday. I was very young. My mother had made a cake from scratch. And there on the table, I could see the exact same bowl. So this must be like my rosebud or something like that.
Your green bud.
That, you know, I didn't realize why it spoke to me when I saw it and why I'm so fanatical about it, but now I understand.
Oh, it's the shape of it is so beautiful. And that is what I grew up with.
Dory, I don't think I've ever had so much fun with show and tell. It's show and tell and shop. So
there we go. Three great things all in one.
Dory Greenspan is the author of Baking, From My Home to Yours. She'll be back in the kitchen with me next week as we bake Gâteau Basque. That's a cake from the Pays Basque region of France. At ABC, a high-profile game of musical chairs appears to have finally come to an end. ABC News President David Weston announced this afternoon that George Stephanopoulos, the network's chief political correspondent, will replace Diane Sawyer as the leading host of Good Morning America. NPR's David Folkenflik reports.
The lineup will look like this. Diane Sawyer will be the chief anchor for the network's evening newscast of record, World News. Stephanopoulos will move from Washington to New York to join co-anchor Robin Roberts on the early morning couch. His runner-up, Chris Cuomo, leaves as the show's newsreader to become the co-host on ABC's weekly news magazine, 2020. But the news story is Stephanopoulos, the host of This Week, ABC's Sunday Public Affairs show. The move is both counterintuitive and inescapable. Counterintuitive because Stephanopoulos had inspired instead to the anchor's chair at the more prestigious World News, a half-hour show with an emphasis on hard news. The network morning shows, by contrast, flit from war to fashion to gossip to entertainment to domestic politics to home life. As former ABC News correspondent Judy Muller says, the morning show requires a light touch.
I'm trying to imagine George Stephanopoulos whipping up a souffle, and it's not coming to me.
But the move is also inescapable, as former CBS News president Andrew Hayward says.
The networks tend to promote the evening news anchor as the so-called face of the network. And traditionally, at a time of crisis, it's the evening news anchors who collectively hold the nation's hand and get us through it.
But that's the prestige. The profits lie elsewhere. As Hayward says, the morning shows for ABC and NBC generate hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue.
In fact, the morning programs for quite a few years now have been much more important in sustaining the news division. And if they didn't have morning programs, they really wouldn't be able to exist. That's not an exaggeration.
Hence, all those interviews Sawyer has done over the years with Nicole Richie.
25 years old. As we said, she became one of the girls who seemed to symbolize what it is to be rich and reckless and in trouble.
With British amateur singer Susan Boyle.
So, Susan, what a sensation this is. Do you wake up every morning now with a smile?
Now, the three most recent evening network news anchors have all been named from morning shows. Diane Sawyer and Charles Gibson at ABC and Katie Couric at CBS. And former ABC reporter Judy Muller says they could handle both light and serious fare.
I think there's actually, in many ways, more skill involved in a two-hour morning show, going from one kind of segment to another quickly, changing gears. The evening news is basically sitting in front of a teleprompter and introducing other correspondents, now and then doing your own interviews. It's a matter of looking credible and having gravitas.
Stephanopoulos has gravitas by the bushel, but acquiring it was a bit of an issue. He first burst onto the national scene as a boy wonder during Bill Clinton's run for president in 1992. Stephanopoulos emerged as a star of the campaign documentary The War Room. He became a senior advisor to President Clinton, and his place in popular culture was assured, as he had inspired characters in the novel Primary Colors and the movie The American President. At the outset of Clinton's second term, Stephanopoulos left the White House and joined ABC News, first as an analyst and later as reporter and anchor. He became known for the earnest questioning of newsmakers, here asking then-House Majority Leader Tom DeLay about his decision to resign.
Your former press secretary pleads guilty going to prison. Your former deputy chief of staff pleads guilty. A criminal enterprise is being run out of your office. How could you not know?
Today, ABC News pulled its Washington insider to Manhattan to headline its most profitable show. The counterintuitive move became inescapable. Stephanopoulos will continue to appear on This Week until a new host is named. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
This is a tough time for any small business, but our Planet Money team has been puzzling over one long-time behavior of businesses, a behavior that seems counterproductive. Stores that sell the same thing and yet cluster together. Seems like that would create too much competition. One place you often see this is New York City. And NPR's Hannah Jaffe Walt and Adam Davidson stopped by some businesses to try to figure it out.
Village Chess is offering a beautiful, hand-carved, antique Italian chess set.
Only $2,000.
They also have Charles Dickens pieces, samurai sets, ancient Chinese sets.
For decades, Village Chess has been the place you go for all of your chess needs.
Well, it was that way. And then, one day, Lawrence Nash, the owner, says one of his employees, actually a protege of his, stabbed him in the back. He set up a shop right across the street.
If somebody you teach then leaves and opens up across the street, there's going to be bad feelings, for sure.
The bad feelings went on for a long time. Within the chess community, it became known as a famous war.
Village Chess hated losing their monopoly on the chess obsessives market. Then something surprising happened after Chess Forum, that's the new competitor, took out an ad in the paper.
All of a sudden, Nash says new people started showing up at Village Chess, his shop, saying things like,
I saw their ad and I saw you and that kind of thing. That's a great feeling. He paid some advertising to get people to come to me. That's a wonderful thing.
The fancy term for this is economies of agglomeration. It means that sellers make this basic calculation.
Sure, you lose a lot of customers to the chess store across the street, but getting more traffic evens things out. Village Chess is no longer one specialty shop on its own. It's now part of New York's chess district.
New York has a lighting district, a plants district, a kitchen supply district, an Indian restaurant district, and then there is this.
We buy gold, diamond, coins, silver. No money, no honey. No money, no honey. We buy.
The district to beat all districts, 47th Street in Manhattan, the Diamond District.
This is not just a couple similar shops on the same block. 47th Street has, and this is an official statistic here, more than 2,600 jewelry sellers.
2,600 little booths of bling crammed into one block. And for years, I've wondered why in the world would somebody want to be jewelry shop number 2,553 alongside so much competition?
Yeah, we asked Peter Kahn, booth number 25 and mall number 37, you could open up your own store in some strip mall in New Jersey where you could be the only one.
I'd do less business, but the prices would be higher, and I'd end up making the same amount of money with probably more aggravation and waiting for somebody to come in and stick a gun in my face, which goes on all the time.
Oh, because diamond stores are always getting held up.
Yeah, it's a dangerous business.
This is the thing about stores clumping together. So you've got that main economic explanation. Extra traffic outweighs the extra competition. But then each industry also has its own special reasons.
Jewelers, like gazelles, think there's safety in numbers.
A plant store owner in New York wants to be in New York's plant district because big buyers for hotels and film shoots, they're not going to drive around to 20 separate shops.
Furniture shops want to be where there's plenty of parking.
And it turns out that the closer you are to shops that are almost exactly the same as yours, the more different you have to be.
Peter Kahn, he's booth number 25, remember? He says his gambit, he's more trustworthy than any other jeweler.
Strangely, booth number 32 and booth number 46 also claim to be uniquely trustworthy.
A few booths down from Peter, an Ecuadorian jeweler says her specialty is to sell to Ecuadorian immigrants. And the guy across from her, his specialty is making really intricate handmade gold rings.
Even when you're all clumped together, actually, especially when you're all clumped together, you've got to show you are one of a kind. Hannah Jaffe Walt.
And Adam Davidson, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, committed to straightforward banking, including customer service with a real human being 24/7. Learn more at allybank.com.